Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are blessed in this program each week to be able to benefit from the very considerable intelligence of our first guest. His name is Gordon Chang. He is, by my lights, the country's preeminent authority on communist China, the threat that it poses to us, and what we should be doing about it. He is an author, notably, of The Coming Collapse of China, an essayist of enormous productivity, notably at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute, among other outlets. And he is a man to be followed closely at Twitter, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
A lot to talk about, Gordon. I thought we might start with an update on the Genocide Games, the Winter Olympics, as they're also known, in Beijing at the moment. A couple of questions. Maybe we could start with Eileen Gu, a young skier who is playing for the other team, it turns out, despite her American citizenship. A question to you, is an American citizen?
We don't know that, Frank. When asked about this, she does not give a clear answer. Now, in contrast, Zhu Yi, who was an American citizen who was skating for China, actually was very clear that she renounced U.S. citizenship. Gu has not, and that leads me to believe that she still has retained her U.S. passport. Now, this raises an interesting question because under Chinese law, a person of Gu's age, she's over 18, is not entitled to maintain dual citizenship. To compete for China, she has to have a Chinese nationality. And that means she had to have given up her U.S. passport. But perhaps China made an exception. Perhaps China is not following its own laws, which is entirely possible. So we should be asking a question whether Gu should be entitled to the gold medal she won in the first women's big air competition. And so we know she's going to be competing later. This is a question that other teams should be raising. Is she entitled to compete for China?
The other question, it seems to me, is whether she's given up her citizenship or not. The fact that she chose to compete for China ought to preclude her return to the United States. Any thoughts on that, whether that can be legally done and whether it should be?
Well, I think that every U.S. citizen, no matter how traitorous or despicable they may be, has a right to come back to the United States. And I don't believe that we should deny any American citizen that right. Nonetheless, when she comes back, I think that we should give her a welcome that is less than welcoming, because she is a traitor. And I think that we can make that point. And I think a lot of that point will resonate with Americans as well. There are a number of Americans who are competing for China in these Olympics. This is despicable on their part, and we Americans need to condemn in the greatest terms, in the most strict terms, our feelings about this.
Well, I certainly agree with that, Gordon. And I guess the question of whether she has a right to come back depends in part on whether she has in fact renounced her citizenship. So that is to be determined, but certainly should be determined before she returns.
Frank, if I could mention for a moment, Frank, if she did give up her U.S. citizenship, she needs a visa. And I believe that she should be denied a visa forever to come to the United States.
Amen. And the others who've done the same. Obviously, this isn't just singling her out. It turns out, though, Gordon, that, and I think you've used the term advisedly, treason and traitorousness. I think this applies equally to a whole host of other people who are increasingly being profiled by organizations like Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation and the Consumers Research Group and the Coalition for a Prosperous America and the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Of course, Peter Schweitzer in his new book, Red Handed. There are many people in our country in various elite circles who are similarly playing for the other team. It seems to me, Gordon, it's high time we hold them accountable as well, no?
Well, of course, because they are undermining freedom and democracy. And they are engaging in activities which they know are helping China and hurting the United States. This most fundamentally is a problem in the political system. And it's a problem of the President of the United States, who has the ability and power to prevent many of these activities. The President can use the powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, or even the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. Presidents have failed to use those powers to the extent that I think that they should. Business is business. Business is amoral. And so therefore, this activity is legal. We should be prohibiting it, though. And the president has the power to do that.
This is long overdue, needless to say. And the extent to which it is continuing in so many circles, especially in the financial sector, with billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars, continuing to migrate from U.S. investors, most of whom are unwitting that their monies are being invested in China by Larry Fink and BlackRock, among others, is something that is at this point simply insane, as well as, I think, indulging in treasonous activity. Gordon, before we leave the genocide games altogether, I did want to ask you for a sort of stock-taking. This was intended to be a propaganda windfall for Xi Jinping and help him with his own position in the internal political dynamics of his country. Is that how it's working out as you see it?
Yeah, we don't know exactly how the top of the Communist Party views these games, but we can tell you, clearly how the rest of the world does. And these are a public, this is a public relations debacle for Beijing on so many different fronts. First of all, the mere fact that they were held in China, in Beijing, gave the world a bigger platform to talk about genocide, crimes against humanity, and China's other dangerous acts. Also, we've seen the way that the Chinese treat athletes, and this has caught the attention of the world. It's not only the athletes who have been put into COVID quarantines, but also others. And I think that this really is an indication that China can't handle this. I think that what will happen, Frank, is that the senior Chinese leadership will understand how the rest of the world has viewed Xi Jinping's Olympics, and they will, in one way or another, punish him. Remember, he wants his third term as General Secretary of the Communist Party, slated to get it at the 20th National Congress, which probably will be held October or November of this year. There are signs of extreme discord at the top of the Communist Party, and they've been evident now for about 3 or 4 months. And that's a real indication that other senior leaders are criticizing Xi Jinping in ways which do destabilize the Communist Party, because they are airing their dirty laundry in public, something the Communist Party is really loath to do and only does when it's at points of distress. So I think right now this is a very dangerous time for the rest of us, because Xi Jinping does have the ability to lash out and the incentive to do it.
Yeah, well, this brings me to the next topic. My speculation is, though, the Biden administration is insisting that the Russians will attack Ukraine in the next day or so, that probably they will hold off by prearrangement with Xi Jinping until these games are done. So it may be just a stay of execution, but it could be next week rather than right now. But the question is, Gordon, will Xi lash out at Taiwan in the event that the Russians do decide to go for it in Ukraine? Do you expect that to be something that may take place in the very near future?
I think the odds of China invading Taiwan go up. if Russia invades Ukraine. And the reason is that there are many good reasons for Vladimir Putin not to invade Ukraine. The United States can cripple Russia, and it can force Putin from power. Putin knows that. And if he invades Ukraine, it means either that he's extremely desperate, which I don't think is the case, or he doesn't believe that the Biden administration will impose those costs on Russia, as Biden has been threatening. This is an issue of political will. Xi Jinping will see that. Xi Jinping knows that that an invasion of Taiwan, if resisted by the U.S., would be a disaster for the Communist Party, could very well lead to the fall of the Communist Party. So if he invades Taiwan, it will be because he thinks the United States won't defend it. And this is, again, an issue of political will. This is one of the more complicated things involving China. And I think that it's really just a question of how they perceive the Oval Office.
Miscalculations are obviously often the basis for conflicts. And this one may be very much a miscalculation about the will of the American people, at least, if not this government. It also perhaps is informed, Gordon, by Joe Biden's playing for the other team, the deep compromise. Our friend Peter Schweitzer, who I mentioned a moment ago, writes in his new book that Joe Biden was a beneficiary of Hunter Biden's dealings with the Chinese Communist Party. I don't think this is necessarily new news, but it's a reminder that we have in the commander-in-chief of the United States someone who the Chinese, rightly or wrongly, calculate is going to bend to their will. Do you see it that way? And if so, would that likely prompt further impetus behind this idea that Xi could usefully invade Taiwan?
In the Chinese elite right now, there is a belief that they do own the White House. I'm not saying it's right, but that's what they believe. So, for instance, Di Dongsheng, the academic from Renmin University, in that infamous live streaming event in China in November 2020, talked about how China owned the U.S. political elite, that China could make offers that could not be refused, but that every American could be bought. And D actually concentrated on Hunter Biden, which got a lot of laughs in the live audience, which is a real indication of China's mentality. There are two reasons to be concerned about China's hold over Joe Biden. One of them is the money. And as I've told you before, I'm not as concerned about the money as I am concerned about the second thing, which is blackmail. Hunter Biden, as we all know, is a troubled individual, even by his own admission. He's been on Chinese soil. If he's done something compromising, the Ministry of State Security will have video recordings, audio recordings, and that could be used as blackmail against the president. We would never know that in all probability. Whereas with the money, as Peter Schweitzer has demonstrated, money always leaves a trail. We will find it out. I know that Biden believes or understands that. And so he is actually constrained by what he can do because of the allegations of Chinese influence peddling and the Biden family corruption. So this is a thing that we've got to worry about in terms of the intimidation. But in any event, Biden policy is not as vigorous as it should be to defend the United States.
That's putting it mildly, I'm afraid. Gordon, it very much remains to be seen whether we will get to the bottom of Joe Biden's compromise. I hope we will, and I hope quite quickly. But you're right. I think the Chinese are calculating that they can take advantage of him. Let me turn to another topic that you've addressed recently, Gordon, which is the extent to which China is actively subverting U.S. sanctions. This is certainly true with respect to its important strategic partnership with Iran. And it seems likely to be true in the event the Russians do invade Ukraine. China will come to Putin's aid in that regard as well. Talk a little bit about the extent to which this is taking place and its implications as you see it.
Iran is selling oil in record quantities. It's selling it to China. That's in violation of U.S. sanctions. Also, we know that China and Russia, but particularly China, are evading UN and US sanctions on North Korea. And we got a hint that China is going to backfill, as the State Department calls it. It's going to backfill Russia. On Thursday, the 3rd of this month, Ned Price, State Department spokesman, warned Chinese companies not to backfill. In other words, to support Russian companies in violation of sanctions. On the following day, the 4th, Vladimir Putin met Xi Jinping in Beijing prior to the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, and the pair announced oil and gas deals in the amount of $117.5 billion. Now, oil and gas under those arrangements won't start for another 2 years, so it's technically not a backfill, but it's clear that China is signaling to the United States that it intends to backfill. And they already have established pipelines, which means that Russia could be selling more hydrocarbons to China at a critical time. So clearly, China is supporting the Russian economy at a time when Biden's main deterrent, form of deterrence, is the imposition of sanctions on Russia should there be an invasion of Ukraine. So it's clear that Putin now has the one piece that he needs to invade Ukraine, and that's not more tanks on Ukraine's border or more ships in the Black Sea. It's Chinese economic support.
And more generally, I think China has his back internationally as well, and it would seem as though all of that will, again, conduce to a Russian calculation. It can go for it in Ukraine. And my suspicion is, as you've suggested, Gordon, that China can do the same with respect to Taiwan and possibly with respect to India as well. You are one of the few people who I think is really paying attention to what they're doing and threatening to do in India. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
It's not just Taiwan, as you point out. China is building up its forces in Ladakh, which is Indian-controlled territory. India has been doing the same thing. So the confrontation that we started to see in May of 2020 could now become a much bigger matter. Also, it's just not just India. I mean, and there are several places where China is threatening India. China is threatening Bhutan. China is threatening Nepal with those incursions in both of those countries. Also, it's Japan and the Philippines. In November of last year, Ned Price, the State Department spokesman, actually issued a warning that the United States was prepared to use force to defend the Philippines at Second Thomas Shoal. And that's extraordinary. We know that the Chinese eventually backed off Second Thomas Shoal, but they've been pressuring that feature in the South China Sea, which is generally considered to be part of the Philippines. They've been continually pressuring that feature, especially since 2012. It could be Japan at the Senkaku Islands. Also, there are a number of different other points in, with other countries on China's periphery that we could see problems. So this is not just a Taiwan issue, although Taiwan seems to be the primary target of China's attention right now. But it could be along its southern and eastern periphery at any point or at many points.
Gordon, one other piece of this, which I don't think is getting the attention that it deserves, is China has actually now created options for, well, making mischief, to put it mildly, literally worldwide with its Belt and Road Initiative. If all it needs to do is to tie up the United States to have reasonable confidence it can get away with murder, whether it's in Taiwan or in any of these other places you've identified, creating problems in Latin America, creating problems in Europe, creating problems in Africa by utilizing its Belt and Road Initiative outposts, the presence of Chinese personnel, if not military personnel, certainly civilians who I'm sure can be called upon to help in these kinds of matters for the motherland, can literally turn any of these problems into a global challenge to us, can they not?
Of course. With Belt and Road, China has penetrated economies around the world, including those very close to us in our hemisphere, in Latin America and the Caribbean. The issue here, especially in our hemisphere, is not so much China's attempting to influence governments, but it's the failure of administration after administration in the U.S. to ensure that we have good relations with our neighbors, our closest neighbors. And we haven't done that, Frank. Of course, China wants to extend its influence. And with its Belt and Road program, it's been successful doing that. I argue that Belt and Road is ultimately going to be a failure for China because it will financially overextend Beijing. But that's a conversation for another day. But the point is that China is making these rapid increases in relations with governments, and some of them very close to us. So this is not only a question of Chinese assertion, it's a failure of America's vision to defend its own turf.
Well, I think you're probably right about that. I think that we're witnessing shortfalls in American involvement in a whole host of places, but in our own, I call it our front yard, it's particularly egregious in Latin America. I think you're almost certainly right that we're going to see the shortfalls in American attention in various places being chickens that will come home to roost badly for us, but it's particularly egregious with respect to our own, I call it front yard in Latin America. Let me just turn to one other point in this sanctions busting business, Gordon. We're making a lot of depriving Russia of access to the SWIFT system, an international mechanism dominated by the United States, thanks to the dollar, for clearing funds through various banking institutions as an important stick with which to threaten Russia if it does invade Ukraine. As we've talked about before, Gordon, the Chinese and Russians are among those who would like to see the SWIFT system over the side in favor of one that they control instead. Should we be concerned about this being another line of attack in a joint Russo-Chinese axis in the event that they do decide to break bad in Ukraine and Taiwan?
We should be concerned about everything that China and Russia does. But their intentions to replace the dollar at the heart of the global financial system are one thing that they can't do. And the reason is that the renminbi, the Chinese currency, is not convertible on the capital account. They have been promising to make it convertible since the turn of the century. They have failed at every time. And the reason is that if they do that, their economy internally falls apart because people will then export cash out of China. So their attempts to have the renminbi replace the dollar, I think, are futile. They can make the renminbi a little bit more acceptable in international transactions. But until they do a couple things, they just can't do this. First of all, they've got to run large current account deficits in order to get their currency outside of the country. They're not willing to do that. And also, they've got to administer their currency fairly so that people will have confidence in the renminbi. They're not willing to do that. And of course, they're not willing to make their currency freely convertible. So the Chinese can talk about this. We should be concerned about the dollar, of course, but we shouldn't allow everyone to intimidate us. And people who say, oh, the dollar is dead, the renminbi is going to take over, that's part of China's intimidation campaign, and we've got to guard against that.
Well, we certainly do. And I think that this digital currency will be an interesting test of whether they can break through some of those constraints that you've talked about before, Gordon. I personally think it will be, again, another instrument for manipulating and controlling the population and other users of the currency, but we'll be watching it closely with your help. Gordon, thank you so much for your time today. As always, you are so generous with it, and it is so helpful to our understanding of the greatest threat we face, arguably in the history of our country, namely the Chinese Communist Party. I know you keep up your great work at Gatestone Institute and elsewhere, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, a former radical leftist who's seen the light and has some very important insights into what the team he used to play for is up to. Metamore, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Team Biden says Russia will initiate its latest invasion of Ukraine tomorrow. The good news is that's probably not true. The bad news is that by pre-arrangement with China's dictator Xi Jinping, the dictator misruling Russia, Vladimir Putin, will likely launch that attack next week once the genocide games in Beijing wrap up. It is in their mutual interest not to detract from that communist Chinese propaganda fest. The really bad news is that after the Chinese Communist Party has milked every ounce of international legitimacy and gold medals out of the Winter Olympics, it's likely to be game on. And not just for Russia and Ukraine. Once that happens, expect to see China piling on in Taiwan, possibly India, and/or elsewhere. Iran and Israel going at it, and perhaps the Korean Peninsula hotting up too. Sound like World War III? This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He has contributed impressively to this program in the past, but not in the recent past, and I'm sorry about that. It's a delight to be able to welcome him back. His name is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He is the author of 11, count them, 11 books, including most recently Thought Criminal, Beyond Woke. He is also the author of Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag, and The Simulation of Freedom, among others. He is a very active contributor to the public policy debate these days through a number of other outlets, notably the Mises Institute, and on his own site, michaelrechtenwald.com. And I couldn't be more pleased to have him here to talk about both the insights that he has about where we are as a nation at the moment, based upon his personal longtime association with the radical left and his, conversion, I guess, for want of a better term, in part having been mugged by reality, I guess it's fair to say. Michael Rechtenwald, it's good to have you back at Secure Freedom Radio, and thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Hi, Frank. It's great to be back.
I thought I might start with just a little level setting. As I say, you've undergone a very profound political transformation yourself. What do you make of the Barack Obama called it fundamental transformation of our country that is being perpetrated at the hands of the hard left with whom you used to associate, now in the government of the United States, executive and legislative branches?
Yeah, I mean, we see the long march through the institutions has been quite successful, and it's already reached well into the state and all the alphabet agencies and corporate America. Basically, under the guise of wokeness, we're seeing the importation of effectively socialist ideas and ideals and implementation of socialist policies throughout the government in every regard. There's a determined effort to lower the expectations of the major, you know, the majority, and then to cater to, you know, completely illegal aliens and to basically accord them the right to vote. It's happened in New York, and if they get their legislation through, luckily the filibuster held up. But the idea is basically to water down the citizens' rights, and including voting rights, to water down their economic power, to basically level the United States with other countries so that we don't have this standard of living. They laugh at the inflation. They laugh at the broken supply chains and the crime wave that is sweeping the country. So this is a playbook. Call it Build Back Better. Call it whatever you want. It's a playbook that they're following to the letter.
You know, it reminds me of, I think it was Lenin's phrase, the worse, the better. The more they can take down the country in all of these particulars, the better for their efforts to, well, not only wield power, but to accomplish a permanent transformation of this nation into something more approximating the socialist or even communist ideal, I fear. When you use the term woke or wokeness, could you just define that for us? Because it's a shorthand for a lot of things, but just to, you know, get us a fix on how you see it and whence it comes.
Well, technically, the woke means, you know, aware and awake to social and political injustice. You know, this is a term that came out of the 1970s and the in African-American community, but has since stood for basically any kind of radical idea that, you know, that we have endemic racism. Whiteness is this evil. All the society, the whole society has been established on the basis of the supremacy of whiteness, and this has to be abolished. So they want to abolish whiteness and to destroy any privilege, quote unquote, that anyone has based on their identities. It really amounts to a targeted campaign to destroy the middle class in America. And that I mean by middle class, not strictly a socioeconomic group, but the wage earning, home owning, business owning and running entrepreneurial class as well, entrepreneurs and, you know, small business owners and so forth. This is a targeted campaign to shame them out of and to guilt trip them out of their minds and completely justify the reduction of their prospects. I think that's really what wokeness comes down to. But it starts off as supposedly for the benefit of the, you know, the underclass, the discriminated against, those who have been supposedly, you know, disenfranchised from the American project by the endemically racist constitution and every law and the legal system and so on and so forth. So it's supposedly about overcoming injustice, but it ends up being about nothing like justice. This is kind of it's a retaliation campaign.
Right. It's terrifying, I think, if it's as you say. And again, Michael, just for the benefit of those who have not been introduced to you before, remind us the authority with which you're describing what this agenda is about and how it is that, you know, you have parted ways with those who adhere to these.
Yeah,
ambitions.
I mean, I was a lifelong leftist, Marxist, university professor at NYU, full professor. I never indoctrinated in the classroom, but I wrote many, many essays from a Marxist standpoint about the economy, about various aspects of social life and so forth. So, you know, spending 20 years as a communist, I think I sort of know what their thoughts are, how they think. And I, you know, came out of it when they turned their sights on me and began shooting, you know, not literally, but really shooting me down, trying to destroy me. I realized, because I made some criticisms of what was going on, you know, and I just had my eyes open, the scales fell from my eyes in an instant. And I realized what kind of a totalitarian character these people and this movement has, and the way it was trying to, you know, the way it will destroy, you know, people, individuals, institutions, or whatever things they see as impediments to this agenda. So, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I renounced the left, and then soon renounced all leftists, Marxism, every strand of the left, identity politics, all of it, because it's all connected.
Well, it is, and to your credit that you've done so. It reminds me of the old line about a conservative being a leftist who's been mugged by reality, and you certainly had that experience. So let's drill down a little bit further on this phenomenon of wokeness as a narrative for accomplishing this fundamental transformation of our country. One of the main strands of this now being used, it seems, as a real weapon, particularly in the business sector that you talked about a moment ago, is the so-called environment, social justice, and governance movement. It has a huge backer in Larry Fink of BlackRock, major financial house on Wall Street. But there are others, and with his active use of BlackRock's immense wealth and leverage in corporate America, he is bending lots of other, you know, corporate boardrooms to his will in this regard as well. Talk us through what ESG entails and why it is now becoming such a problem in the business community and for the country.
The ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance Index, is an index on the stock exchanges, of course, and it's putatively meant to rate corporations on their environmental, social, and governance quotients. You know, how are they abiding by environmental, social, and governance issues, in particular the climate change issue with reference to the environmental. And the social really is about social justice. How well are they catering to social justice demands for so-called diversity on boards and in the company's management? And then governance, how does the corporation behave with reference to the social body, and in particular, how they also interact with the government. Are they abiding by government policies and dictates? So really what they're doing is a means of, first of all, diverting money to these preferred ESG high-scoring companies and away from the non-compliant, to divert money away from these. They say that these policies, as Vanguard puts it, these are exclusionary policies. They're meant to destroy the capital financing of these corporations that aren't abiding. And it really is targeting the oil and gas industries, particularly, to defund them. And it even goes to the point of debanking some of these companies if they don't abide by these precepts. So, and you know, there's a tremendous hypocrisy involved too, because the ESG really has a double standard, especially where China's concerned, because China is getting enormous assets diverted into their companies' coffers by Larry Fink and by Vanguard and others. They're investing, you know, up to a third of all the money. And BlackRock holds $10 trillion worth of assets it manages. It manages assets to a huge amount of the economy. So they're funding these Chinese companies, which happen to have connections to the Chinese military and technology firms that aid in the surveillance and voice recognition and face recognition, and they're used to to enslave the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And so this has very enormous implications in terms of the geopolitical, economic, and humanitarian concerns that we have regarding China.
In short, you're saying that Larry Fink and his ilk are compelling American corporations to comport themselves in certain ways, that the Chinese Communist Party wants no part of, and despite that, despite China's deplorable record on the environment, the utter absence of justice of any kind, social or otherwise, by the Chinese Communists, to say nothing of, you know, transparent and accountable governance for their corporate fronts. Larry Fink, and again, I single him out because he is the 800-ton gorilla in this operation, and others that he is inducing, to, you know, do the same, are greatly enabling, totally non-ESG Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, I mean, the Chinese companies are supposedly abiding by ESG. Many Chinese companies are ESG reporting companies. Nevertheless, because of the lack of transparency and the manipulation by the state over these corporate reports, you know, we have no idea what their real standards are. In fact, we can tell by their politics, by the way the country's run. So what they're doing is disabling American companies and benefiting Chinese companies, using the ESG to cripple companies in the United States and the West in general, while allowing the ESG's porous reporting and terrible lack of transparency in China to actually differentially benefit Chinese companies as against the American companies. So it's a horrible development and a very dangerous one. It has security implications, national security implications. It has human rights implications. It has economic implications, which of course tie back into the military and the militarism of China and their posturing, at least their apparent desire to take over Taiwan. And I mean, this is just a terrible development out of corporate America.
I was talking with Gordon Chang earlier about this in the program, Michael Rechtenwald, and observing that this really does, I think, equate to treason.
I mean, it could be, yes.
Play it out to its logical conclusion, enabling, abetting, empowering, emboldening our mortal enemies, which is the upshot of all of this, weakening America in the process, of course, as well, is, tantamount to that, it seems to me.
It's amazing that our investments in China, which were supposedly predicated on the idea that they would liberalize China, have actually done nothing of the sort with reference to China, but instead it's deliberalized the United States. And so we've
ended
us
more like them rather than them like us. Yeah. Yeah, terrifying thought. And as you say, and again, one of the reasons why we so value your contributions to this program, Michael, is you know whereof you speak. This is not sort of hypothetical or an abstraction. This is what you studied and actually, you know, were working towards for a time during your earlier incarnations. And so more credit to you for, you know, both departing from all of that, of course, but also sounding the klaxon as to what's afoot here. As you look at what we could do about all of this, is there any hope? I sense, and I again mentioned this to Gordon too, that we're seeing a growing degree of effort being made to challenge those who are betraying our country in this fashion, whether it's in the financial sector or other corporate entities, in Hollywood, in the media more generally, in politics, not least. But that's a, you know, aircraft carrier changing direction kind of problem. It takes time, and it's not going to be easy, perhaps. But What would you counsel we be doing, those of us who love this country and who do not want it transformed in this fashion, do not want to see ourselves, you know, enslaved basically by the left and its communist agenda? What can we do as you see it?
Well, in terms of the corporate wokeness, I would say that the key here, first of all, it's going to fail miserably in the sense that it's burdening companies tremendously with not only bureaucracy, but outrageous policies that are can't be maintained, that will starve us out of oil, will starve us out of natural gas, will actually cause tremendous inflation, greater inflation on oil and gas, and effectively create bottlenecks where we're not getting it, and shortages even. So this is going to create incredible pressure from below, because people will not stand by once their bank account, once their pocketbook is affected. This is going to create a tremendous amount of resistance. And that's good, because that's what's going to take. But divestment in the meanwhile, divesting from these corporate funds, from ESG funds, and it's all very possible you can find stocks that are actually not on the ESG and actually anti-ESG. But more importantly, I think that we need to keep raising awareness about this. And I'll be speaking to a congressional committee about all these matters and talking to them about what kinds of policies can be enacted to overcome this. And of course, the midterm elections are incredible. This is not to be strictly a Republican partisan, but we must get rid of these people before they completely do transform this country into a socialist hellhole like Venezuela. That's the prospect, and that's, we need to keep that history in mind. We have to keep that in their faces. We must remind them of what their these kind of policies have led to in other places, and we must show them that we are not going to stand for it.
Amen to all of that. I can't tell you how excited I am to learn that someone in Congress, I can't imagine it's the majorities in either the House or Senate that have invited you to speak, but that someone in Congress has seen the necessity of giving you a platform on Capitol Hill. It can't come soon enough or be, you know, widely shared an opportunity as it needs to be, but it's a start, and congratulations, and we look forward to having you back to talk about it and to otherwise contribute to our understanding, Michael Rechtenwald, because whether it's on this woke business, the nature of it, its agenda, whether it's on the tie-in to the Chinese Communist Party and its designs to take us down as a nation, whether it's the combination of the two, which is palpable, your insights from personal experience, as well as the incredible clarity that you bring to discussions of all these topics is so appreciated and so desperately needed. So we'll look forward to a visit with you in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you, sir, for what you're doing and for joining us often in the days to come. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Team Biden says Russia will initiate its latest invasion of Ukraine tomorrow. The good news is that's probably not true. The bad news is that by pre-arrangement with China's dictator Xi Jinping, the dictator misruling Russia, Vladimir Putin, will likely launch that attack next week, once the genocide games in Beijing wrap up. It is in their mutual interest not to detract from that communist Chinese propaganda fest. The really bad news is that after the Chinese Communist Party has milked every ounce of international legitimacy and gold medals out of the Winter Olympics, it's likely to be game on. And not just for Russia and Ukraine. Once that happens, expect to see China piling on in Taiwan, possibly India, and or elsewhere. Iran and Israel going at it, and perhaps the Korean Peninsula hotting up too. Sound like World War III? This is Frank Gaffney. This is Frank Affney, and this is My Take. Is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi auditioning for her next gig? If so, her recent behavior suggests that she has her sights set on the role of our time's Tokyo Rose, the voice of collaboration with our mortal enemy, namely the Chinese Communist Party. After all, her warning to America's Olympians not to anger the ruthless Chinese Communist regime was unnecessary for anyone now in the genocide games totalitarian bubble. They're under no illusion about the police state in which they are competing and that they are legitimating by doing so. Rather, Mrs. Pelosi seems to be trying to impress on the rest of us that the CCP's rise is inevitable and that resistance to it is dangerously futile. This appalling performance, however, may be a function not of her future aspirations, but of her past compromise. As Peter Schweitzer reports in his superb new book, Red Handed, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. During her time in Congress, Mrs. Pelosi's husband has earned many tens of millions of dollars in Chinese government-approved deals. The trouble is that Beijing Nancy's currently the third in line to the presidency. Worse yet, the two people north of her in the constitutional food chain are a commander-in-chief long ago bought by the CCP and a vice president notorious for her Marxist ideological zeal. It's hard to overstate the dire implications of such treachery at this particular moment. The new axis declared last week by China's Führer, Xi Jinping, and his Mussolini, Vladimir Putin, poses the greatest threat to the free world since the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact of 1939. Quite apart from the devastating effect of the Biden wrecking operation's ignominious Afghan collapse, the CCP and our other ruthless enemies around the world, from Iran to Pakistan to North Korea to the Marxists now dominating Latin America, have all been empowered and emboldened by this nation's takedown by their allies and enablers inside the United States. Perhaps such foes will refrain from exploiting this opportunity until November, when we have a chance for a major course correction. We should not plan on such a hope, however. Instead, we must bend every effort to deterring the incipient aggression clearly being prepared and telegraphed by the new Axis and its comrades. That must begin with publicly repudiating Beijing Nancy and the others among our elites captured by and working for our truly ruthless enemies. Learn more at securefreedom.org.